Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I'm very grateful to the director, Herr Schneider, and also to Professor Martina Ghosh-Shellhorn for giving me the opportunity to come here today and talk to you. I'm sorry I don't know German, but I presume that all of you know English. And if you don't understand some things I said, then maybe afterwards you can ask me questions. There are people to translate, and we can have a bit of a dialogue as well. As Ramin said, the title of my brief talk to you this evening is Shakuntala, a Love Story. And in a way, it's not central to what you're probably going to see, in the sense that, as I understand it, there are at least three stories going on here. One, of course, is the story of how Schubert wrote this opera, or started writing it in 1820 or thereabouts, and then it was left unfinished. And then a Norwegian composer, I'm told, finished it. And then in the 21st century, you've had it presented in a full-scale performance for the first time by Herr Schneider here. So that is one story, which I know very little about. He will tell you more about it if you're interested. And there's another story, which also I'm not going to talk about that much. But that is the story of the rise of German Romanticism and how German Romanticism appropriated material from the East, particularly from India, to discover itself or to discover certain aspects of its own self, a European self, which was then, in a sense, extremely influential in other parts of Europe, including England. And that is the story of how Herder translated the English translation of Shakuntala, which was made in the 1780s by William Jones, I think 1789. And in a couple of years, in about 1791 or 92, it was already in German. Now, why was this play, which was originally written in Sanskrit, maybe in 200 or 300 AD, because the dates of Kalidas, the poet and the writer who wrote this play, his dates are uncertain, but he's considered the greatest dramatist of classical India, who wrote in the Sanskrit language, okay? And of course, the story of Shakuntala is older than Kalidasa. It goes back to the Mahabharata, which is the great Indian epic. And it's also reputedly the longest poem in the world. It is about 200,000 lines long. It's written in 100,000 verses, and each verse is a couplet, is two lines long. And Mahabharata means sort of the great India, and it really has everything that you need to know about not just India, but practically about anything, because it is said that whatever is in life is in Mahabharata, and whatever is not in the Mahabharata is not in life. You know, that's what they say. But why did these important German writers, thinkers, philosophers translate this play, which was first, as I said, in Sanskrit language, then put into English, and then later it influenced many other German writers, thinkers, the Schlegel brothers, Goethe, many others were influenced by this translation of Shakuntala. And it gave rise to, or it added to the impetus of what is called German Romanticism, which was in a way influenced, inspired by a sort of German reconstruction of what the Orient was. And it had to do with discoveries of languages, kinship between the so-called Aryan people, and the idea that the East was the home of some original wisdom. And of course, we know that the Romantics romanticized their idea of India. In other words, their notion of India was not exactly historically correct or well-informed, but they, in some sense, thought that India represented some quintessential wisdom, which was vital to Europe's own self-discovery. And there's a wonderful account of this in a book by Raymond Schwab. It's an old book. It was written in the 60s, called The Oriental Renaissance. And the argument in this book simply is that Europe goes through two renaissances. One, of course, starting in the 14th, 15th century, with Italy and spreading all over. And that's the discovery of the classical past of Europe, you know, the non-Christian Greek and Latin texts, which in a sense gives rise to the beginnings of science and rhetoric and so forth in modern Europe. And then he says that there was a second Renaissance, and this was the Oriental Renaissance. And this was the discovery of the classics of the East, of India, China, Persia. And together they formed modern Europe and modern European consciousness, because the second Renaissance was very closely linked to the European Enlightenment, you know, which happens in the late 18th century. And this was the time when, as we know, Shakuntala and many other Sanskrit texts were being translated into English and other European languages. And one of the things that happens, one of the new sciences that is born from this discovery is, of course, linguistics, where you do comparative philology and you begin to realize that Greek, Latin, Sanskrit, Persian are all sister languages, and that there is a great Proto-Indo-European culture and civilization with many common things. So that's another story I'm not going to tell. I just sort of briefly touched upon it. But the third story is really the story of what Shakuntala comes to mean to Indians over the ages. And again, there is a very good account of this. One of India's leading historians has written about the different ways in which Shakuntala has been represented in art and culture, in history, and in the Indian imagination, starting with the Mahabharata representation. And Herr Schneider just told me that you're going to hear an original passage from the Mahabharata today, but in English translation. And I just wanted to say that the Mahabharata Shakuntala is a much stronger, forthright, candid woman who challenges the king in the court when he doesn't recognize who she is. I'll tell you about that in a second. But the thing that Kalidas does, the playwright from where William Jones translates Shakuntala, is that he makes Shakuntala a very soft and a very romantic, sensuous kind of woman, not the tough Shakuntala of the Mahabharata who can speak up to the king. So there's already a romanticization, in a sense, of Shakuntala. And what I would try to suggest is that Shakuntala is very important to Indian romanticism down the ages. And that's why I've called Shakuntala an Indian love story. And now let me explain what I mean by that. You see, at a very basic level, Shakuntala indirectly is the story of India, because Shakuntala has a son called Bharat, you see. And this Bharat, who is actually a product of a love marriage, you see. Most of my friends here know that in India, even today, more than 80% of the marriages are arranged, right? But Shakuntala's is actually a love marriage, which I'll talk about in a moment. But Shakuntala's son is called Bharat, and Bharat gives the name to India, because the traditional name of India is Bharat. So if you look at the, if you go to Google and look up the Republic of India, then you'll see that the English name of India is the Republic of India, but the Indian name is Bharat Ganarajya. Ganarajya simply means republic, or some democratic republic, but the name for India, the traditional name for India, is Bharat. And so Shakuntala's son is the king, a very famous mythical ancient king, who gave India its original name, Bharat. And that's why I call it, you know, the story from which the name or the notion of India itself emerges. And how is Bharat born? I mean, that is a sort of subtext or the subplot of this story. It starts with this king called Dushyant. He is going out hunting. That's how the play begins. I don't know if that's how it is here, but in the original, the king has gone out hunting in a chariot, which is drawn by these horses, and the chariot is very close to the quarry, which is a deer, which is panting and running away, and the king is about to release the arrows. Just then, there is a very young hermit, you know, in the robes, or the costumes of a hermit, who says to the king, O king, stop. And the king is shown in the original to rein in the horses. And the horses are also a bit upset because they're very close to, you know, they know what's going on, the hunt is going on. But the reining in of the horses is symbolic of the king's ability to control his senses, because the horses are seen as all the senses which always run outward. And because he's a good and great king, he's able to restrain himself and the arrow is not released. And the hermit says, stop, king, because this is a protected animal. This deer belongs to the hermitage of a famous sage whose name is Kanwa Rishi. And since it's a protected animal, you're not supposed to hunt this deer. So the king apologizes because there's this relationship between the court of the king and the hermitage of the sage. Because these are the two worlds of the play, and they're also the two worlds, like in the worlds of Shakespeare, where you've got the court of the king and then you've got the world of the forest, where people go, you know, as in Twelfth Night or As You Like It, people go off and retreat into the forest. And there's always a dialectic between the pastoral world, the unspoilt world of the hermitage, where nature is innocent and unfallen, and the world of the king, the world of the court, the world of power, the world of prestige, and also the world of calculation, money, corruption, and so forth. And the king and the sage, they have this kind of relationship in which, in the hierarchical order of ancient India, the sage is higher than the king. So the king has to bow to the sage. So anyhow, the king dismounts from the chariot, apologizes, goes to the hermitage, and there he beholds Shakuntala. And Shakuntala is this unspoiled, virginal young woman who is just awakening to the knowledge of who she is. And she's never been outside the hermitage, and she's completely identified with the spirit of nature, because the birds and the animals and the plants and the trees and the flowers, they all speak to her. She's very close to them all. And Shakuntala herself is the daughter of a celestial damsel and a sage. And she's been raised by her foster father, who's the sage Kanwa. And of course, Dushyant, this king, who's a very experienced man with probably, you know, a man of the world, and this utterly untouched, sylvan, beautiful, you might say forest nymph, Shakuntala, they fall in love. And the love is consummated and in the form of a love marriage. Because among the ancient marriage rites in India, one form of marriage is called the Gandharva Vivaha. And in this form of the marriage, you don't need any witnesses, you don't need any ceremonies. If a man and woman love each other, they can marry each other. And late night in the forest, the stars and the earth are witness, and they accept each other as man and wife. And after a while, what happens is that Dushyant has to leave because he's the king. But he promises Shakuntala that he will call her in a few days or in a short period of time. And so he leaves, and here is Shakuntala thinking about her husband and lover and this king. And of course, she hasn't told anybody that they've got married. And to her good fortune or misfortune, depending on how you look at it, she discovers she's pregnant. And so after a while, the story cannot be hidden anymore. And so she's going to tell her foster father. But just when she's very depressed and sad that her husband has not called her, a very, a peculiar man who's another sage, he comes to the hermitage. And he finds Shakuntala absorbed in her own thoughts. And he's a very angry sage. And these sages are very prone to cursing people when they feel that they're, you know, not behaving properly. So he says, young woman, the man or the person you're thinking of just now will forget you, just as you've forgotten to show the rules of hospitality to the visitors of this hermitage. So she wakes up and everybody around her, her girlfriends and others, are very, very upset that the sage has within quotes, cursed her. So they say, please, 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 you know, she's very innocent and she's not to blame. And can you not take back your words? But the sage's curse cannot be taken back. But he's properly fed and mollified and flattered. So he thinks he should offer some palliative. So he says, okay, he will forget you. But if you show him something that he has given you, he will remember you again. So Shakuntala is very happy because she has the ring, the king's signet ring, which he has given her as a token of his love. And so Shakuntala is sent to the king's court with her escorts. But then what happens is terrible because she goes to the court, and because of the sage's curse, he does not recognize her. And he says literally, "Woman, I do not know thee." And she's shocked, and she says, "But you're my husband, and we met in such and such a place, and such things happened, and we were married, and this and that." And of course the king says, you know, any person who comes up the street and claims to be the wife of the royal, whatever majesty, do you think that she will get all the privilege, and so etc., etc. And then she remembers the curse, and she says, "Yes, yes, but I have your ring." And she puts up her finger, and there's no ring. So what has happened? Because before she came to the palace, she went for a wash in the river, and the ring has fallen off. And so her escorts leave. They said, "This is a matter between husband and wife. What can we do?" And so Shakuntala leaves the court in great shame. And then the story doesn't end there. That's one half of the film. Or not film, but the play. I'm so influenced by Bollywood now. I'm talking about Bollywood and films in my class at the university. So I keep talking about film. So pardon me. But anyhow, what happens is that a fisherman has caught that fish. And while cutting it open, he's discovered the ring. And the guards of the palace have said, "This is a royal ring. So you must have been stealing from the king. So, you know, off with your head." So he's brought to the king's court and said he's been caught stealing a ring. And the fisherman says, "I promise I did not steal the ring. It was in the belly of a fish." But the king looks at the ring, and then he remembers everything. And it's very beautifully done in the original, because even when the king has forgotten Shakuntala, he's terribly, terribly unhappy. He's melancholy. And the allegorical meaning of that is that we've all forgotten something which makes us unhappy. We've forgotten our original connection with something that is very deep and true and takes us back to our authentic selves. But we forget that, and so we become very unhappy. So the king doesn't know the cause of his melancholy. But the moment he sees the ring, he remembers Shakuntala, and then he realizes what a big sin he's committed. He's not recognized his wife, and he worries about her. He sends everywhere his people to look for her, and of course she can't be found. And so now the story comes to its culmination, where the king of the gods, like Zeus, he's called Indra, he invites Dushyant to help him in a fight with the asuras or the demons, you know. And because he's a great and noble king, he goes and assists Indra. And Indra sends him back first class, as it were, in his own aerial chariot, in his golden chariot. And on his way back to his kingdom, he stops, you know, as a rest stop. He stops at the hermitage of another sage called Maricha. And he enters the hermitage and he sees a little boy playing with the lion cubs. So he's really fearless. And he feels a great affinity to this child and goes and picks him up. And the child says, "Put me down, put me down. No one but the king may touch me because I'm the king's son." So holding this child, he enters the hermitage and he sees Shakuntala, and there's a grand reunion. And that little child is Bharat. And that is how India gets its name. Now, why do I call this an Indian love story? Because it contains the quintessential formula of Indian love stories. And that formula is not lost and found, or lost and lost, or found and lost. You know, because if it's a tragedy, it is found and lost. I mean, you find your love and you lose your love, and that's the end of it. like Romeo and Juliet, and it's a terrible tragedy. And it's not lost and found, which is that you've lost your love and you then found him or her, as the case may be, and you live happily ever after. But the quintessential Indian formula is found, lost, and found. And in that sense, therefore, you cannot have an Indian tragedy, because in India, death is never the final termination, because what is left unresolved here on the earthly plane is always resolved in some other level, at some other plane. But in this case, the formula found, lost and found implies that the first time that love is found, it's more innocent, it's unpremeditated, it's beautiful. But without the loss, you do not understand what love really means. And the renewal of love is considered more profound. And the loss is what makes the final reunion, you know, a happier reunion. And why do I say that this allegorizes Indian philosophy itself? Because Indian philosophy is also not a philosophy of original sin and redemption, but it is a philosophy of original perfection, because of one's identity with, if you like, your maker or divinity, because every soul is perfect and divine according to Indian philosophy. And then there is the whole episode of birth in between, the interregnum, where there is sorrow and happiness, pain and pleasure, joy and suffering, separation and union, and all the opposites, hot and cold, which human beings in a human body suffer. But without that experience of the human, the reunion, which is the re-establishment of the cosmic order, where you recognize your identity with your own divine nature, is incomplete. So just found is, would not be a happy story. But found has to be lost, and taking birth, becoming human, is a prelude to regaining your original divinity. So that's what, in a sense, becomes the message of India, which, though the Romantics did not spell it out so much, they intuited unconsciously this great idea and felt deeply attracted to it. And that is how, even later in Rousseau, you get the idea of the noble savage, the unfallen human being, which in a sense is a quintessential Indian idea that we are all divine and we are all children of immortality. We are not children of death, suffering, and sin, but we are all perfect, and our original nature is the Buddha nature, if you wish, if you want to use Buddhist terminology, but it runs throughout Indian philosophy. And I've now come to the conclusion of my talk, because when you look at the etymological meaning of Bharat, which is linked to Bharat, it has two kinds of connotations. One is the dhatu, or the root word in Sanskrit, signifies light. And you have, because of words like Prabhat and Bhaskar. Bhaskar is the word for the sun. So Bhaskara. Kara means doer. Bhas is light. So Bhaskara, light maker, is the sun. So Bharat is that which shines and illumines. And the other idea of Bhar becomes like weight or responsibility. And I try to link up these two by saying that through the ages, if you look at the idea of India, everybody knows that India is a place. India is a country today. But India is not just a place. India is also a perspective. And India is not just a country, but India is also a metaphysic, as Raja Rao said in Serpent and the Rope. And what is it that India stands for? From this romantic perspective. That's why I said Shakuntala is important to Indian romanticism. It's important because India stands for light and illumination. I mean, regardless of, you know, all the other things of India that you may see in Slumdog Millionaire, you know, which is not a very good portrayal. So we in India don't like that film very much. but it's an entertaining film, and it makes other people feel good about themselves. When there's a terrible economic crisis, you say, oh, India is such a bad place, I'm happy to be where I am, you know. So it serves another purpose. But despite all the other things about India, all the bad things, through the ages, India has also stood for this, for inner light, for illumination. And that, in a sense, is India's responsibility. So when I call Shakuntala an Indian love story, I tell my friends and people who are interested in India that the birth of India happens in love. And it is a special kind of love in which the formula is found, lost and found. And the end result of this formula is some form of illumination, inner and outer. Thank you very much. Thank you.